Chapter 6. The Seal Train. The war experience, like the experience of every crisis in history, every calamity and every turning point in a man's life, dulls the minds and breaks the spirit of some, but enlightens and tempers others. V.I. Lenin. The first 2 hours of the ride were almost jolly after that, at least by Bolshevik standards. From Zurich, the local train rattled along a valley studded with the chilly stumps of vines. Most of the passengers relaxed. Dun-coloured farms and distant slopes had been home territory for years. As the train slowed, just outside Neuhausen am Rheinfall, there was a momentary gasp as everyone looked to the right. The tracks here curved above the largest waterfall in Europe. But those short minutes of romance were forgotten as the station at Neuhausen came into view. For it was one of the last before the border. A posse of Swiss customs men was waiting for the Russian group a few miles up at Schaffhausen. The Germans may have promised a free passage to this foreign exile band, but now the Swiss were making it clear that they had never signed the deal. Lenin's group was shepherded off the train. As they waited on Platform 3, officials of the Swiss police rummaged through the baskets of blankets, books and provisions that they had brought for their journey. It turned out that there was a wartime rule about exporting food from Switzerland. The cheese and sausages were too much. The hard-boiled eggs would have to go. It was a shock to watch as an entire week's supply of sustenance was snatched away, and the process itself, which left a few bread rolls precisely counted and a docketed receipt, was enough to set anyone's nerves on edge. At Thingen, not far up the line, a fresh squad of uniformed men demanded to go through everything again. When the Swiss train came to its final stop at Gottmadingen, with Germany just yards away, the passengers were close to panic. To their despair, as they scanned the platform outside, they spotted two unsmiling figures in grey uniforms, the hard-faced types that people send when they are planning a surprise arrest. Those German officers were hand-picked men. Leutnant von Buring was the younger of the two. The travellers were not to be informed, but he had been selected for the job because he understood Russian. Along with his superior, Captain von der Planitz, he had been briefed for the mission by the Director of German Military Operations, General Erich Ludendorff, in person. After the sterile bureaucrats of Switzerland, Buring and Planitz made a terrifying pair, all gleaming boots and razor-sharp salutes, and now, like cartoon baddies in a wartime film, they ordered the Russians to form two lines inside the third-class waiting room, the men on one side and the women and two children on the other. Instinctively, the men surrounded Lenin, like so many ants around their hypertrophic queen. Several minutes passed, and although no one dared to speak, most wondered privately how they had fallen for this German trap. The pause may have given the Germans time to count their guests, to watch them, or merely to organize their bags. It may have been a calculated move to show the Russians who was boss. When the officers were satisfied, they ushered their small party from the station building without volunteering an explanation. Outside, the engine waited, already spewing out white steam. Berlin had honoured its agreement to the letter. This was a journey that would cost so much in resources and precious time on railroad tracks that the Germans might as well have thrown in feather beds and free champagne. But the exiles had asked for cheap seats. And those were now exactly what they got. The single wooden carriage, painted green, consisted of 3 second-class compartments and 5 third-class ones, 2 toilets and a baggage room for the emigres' baskets. This was to be the famous Seal Train, though what the security amounted to was merely that 3 of the 4 doors on the platform side were locked after the passengers had all been counted on board. There was an awkward moment as the Russians debated who might sit where. After a token protest, Lenin and his wife agreed to take the first of the three second-class compartments at the front. The other two were offered to families with women and children, starting with Georgi Safarov and his wife Valentina, Inessa Amon and Olga Ravitch. These settled down with Radek in the compartment behind Lenin's, while the Zinovievs joined two other couples in the next one. The rest took their places in third class, resigned to stiff limbs and drowsy fug. The German guard sat in the back. To preserve the illusion that the Russians would have no contact with the enemy, a chalk line had been drawn on the carriage floor between their territory and the rest. The only person who could cross it was the Swiss, Fritz Platten, who had become the entire company's official middleman. As the train slowly headed north, Lenin stood at his dark window, a modest figure in a dusty suit, thumbs locked into his waistcoat pockets. Beyond his own reflection in the glass, he could see that the alder woods were turning green. Despite the lengthening shadows, it was still possible to make out yellow celandines and white anemones, the first wild flowers of a spring to come. The valley broadened, opening to fields. Switzerland vanished into the trail of steam. The rhythmic rattle of the train encouraged a feeling of momentum, purposeful and progressive. The mood was soothing, hypnotic. But before Lenin really yielded to it, the brakes engaged and his momentary trance evaporated. Though the last light had gone, the train seemed to have stopped under a monstrous crag, the Hohenzweil, an extinct volcano that rose 2,000 feet like an outsized pyramid against the paler darkness of the night. Topped by the ruins of a 10th-century border fortress, it was the only attraction of the town of Zingen, which was where the Russians were about to spend the night. Looming above them near the track, a factory stood witness to the epic powers of the capitalist mode of production. As vast and brutal as any fortress, the point of this particular colossus was to turn out never-ending streams of Maggie's celebrated powdered soup. The Russian's carriage was parked in a siding, and the German crew went home to bed. The factory had closed up for the night. The meadows and the woods beyond were silent, and the small town slept. As if to compensate, however, some of the travellers were making a great deal of noise. The background clatter of the moving train had masked the fact. But the party in the compartment next to Lenin's was a raucous one. The occupants had been singing verses of the Marseillaise in Switzerland. Now the very walls were rocking, as wave upon wave of laughter burst upon the night, interspersed with Radek's baritone and the shrill voice of Olga Ravitch. The merriment was fueled by German beer, which Planitz and Buring had bought at a shop in town and passed across the chalk line, with a pile of sandwiches by way of dinner for their guests. Lenin was not the type to tolerate disturbances of any kind, he muttered, then tried knocking against the compartment wall. Escape was impossible. He could not even disembark and stretch his legs. It was in Zingen, that first night, that he began to formulate his famous in-train rules. The first of these made sleeping at specific hours into a matter of communist discipline. No longer optional, it was redesignated as the comrade's Bolshevik duty. In furtherance of that great task, Lenin also tried to exile Ravitch to a compartment towards the back. This rough injustice was too much, not least because it had been Radek who was making the most noise. Ravitch was rescued by her fellow passengers, and Lenin could do nothing but walk to his own compartment and close the door. As the last of the sandwiches was finished, everyone else was reduced to whispering, fidgeting, and stifling their giggles. They also reached for cigarettes. From the first, Lenin had banned smoking in the compartments and corridors. Since no one could step out for a quick puff, that left a single toilet in the Russian zone, the other at the back of the carriage was in German territory. An impossible queue formed very fast, as the passengers who needed to use the toilet for its intended purpose were forced to wait for a procession of smokers. The Bolshevik leader's solution, which Radek dubbed his organisational party work, was to issue tickets, giving the smokers second-class passes to the toilet, which could be trumped by other users' first-class ones. The move reduced the noisy queue outside the leader's door. But Radek and his comrades went on arguing for hours about the relative importance in philosophical terms of the two different types of physical imperative. No one got much sleep. Dawn found the Russian sore and strained, red-eyed, aching and sour of breath. When the sound of the engine started up at 5 a.m., drowning the song of blackbirds in a shriek of steam, the rattle and the movement must have come as a relief. Their route that second morning, Tuesday the 10th of April, the 28th of March by the Russian calendar, ran up the Neckar Valley between the Black Forest and the Swabian Alps. The travellers were dozing as their carriage passed the Gothic town of Rottweil and the ancient castle at Horb. These quiet hills were soothing, punctuated only by villages that looked like children's wooden toys, each with its church and neat shingled steeple. It struck the travellers that there were few people about. The fields were neglected, and there were almost no men of working age to tend them. As they consumed the last stale rolls, brushing the crumbs off their plank seats, they also saw how thin and weary everybody seemed. The villagers stared back if the train slowed, and it was only when the Russians learned that almost no German had seen a white bread roll since 1914 that they understood the hungry and intently hostile looks. The German press had prudently reported who the passengers were. Here at last was an opportunity for Berlin to appear benevolent, but it was their status as well-nourished human beings, not as socialists or Russians, that drew these peasants' unkind stares. There was little pleasure to be gained from contemplating German landscapes and grey waterfalls. The adult members of the party knew the country well enough from the conferences of their pre-war days. They knew the railway, too, and recognised the stations. Tuttlingen, Herrenberg, Stuttgart yet to come. Even Lennon stopped hovering at his window, while everyone else dozed or chatted, waiting in the queue to smoke. They tried to suppress the disturbing sense of loss that ravaged Germany evoked in them, for they had known it as a grand and prosperous place, an inspiration for the future of the world. Whenever the train slowed or halted, the thin, tired faces swam into the Russians' view, pale, haggard and unsmiling after years of war. Even the cities seemed devoid of men. But at some stations, angry women crowded round the carriage windows, shaking their fists or blocking the light with pages from the German press that showed cartoons of the dishonoured Tsar. Someone told Elena Uzievich that the police were trying to keep such people well back from the train, but the sight of those malnourished wraiths went on to haunt her for decades. The more ebullient Russians preferred to interpret the suffering they could see as proof that Germany was on the brink of a revolution of its own. Such good news called for more rounds of the Marseillaise. As the strains of the revolutionary anthem drifted over Baden-Württemberg, the guards called Platten in to point out that the locals might not relish loud French songs. Chastened, the singers settled down again to doze. There was a bit of entertainment in the middle of the day. It started when the worthy Platten was summoned down the swaying car into the German zone. Captain von der Planitz wanted to know if Lenin might be willing to meet a new guest. Wilhelm Janssen was now on the train. The plan to insert him at Gottmaningen as a representative of the German trade unions had been abandoned, but he'd been smuggled on board at Karlsruhe in the hope that Lenin's hand might still be forced. The first thing to do was to hide Radek. As an Austrian citizen, he could hardly claim to be a Russian exile on his way to Petrograd. Unkind outsiders might point out that he was liable for army service at the front, and there were members of the German trade union movement who wanted him questioned on pre-war charges of theft, those books, that overcoat, and someone's hat, as well as the embezzlement of party funds. To get him out of Janssen's sight, he was bundled into the goods compartment with a large supply of newspaper to keep him quiet. Then Lenin sent his official response to Janssen's comradely request. "Tell him," he instructed Platin, "that if he enters our part of the carriage, we will beat him up." The single carriage was devoid of comfort, but at least Lenin and his fellow travellers had just about sufficient room. In Russia, where scores of other revolutionaries had been heading westwards to the capital from their exile in Siberia, the luxury of German third-class seats was unimaginable. As soon as the Soviet had granted soldiers permission to use civilian transport, rail journeys had been transformed into brute contests for space. The carriages came close to bursting, as the men in great coats crammed aboard, troops on their way back to the front, soldiers in training or on leave, and even small packs of deserters leering hungrily at well-dressed girls. On shorter trips, passengers clung in desperation to the outside doors. Protesting carriage springs began to break under the weight. A British envoy, with a coupe reservation for Baku, arrived at the station in Petrograd to find that his seats had been taken by a party of soldiers and sailors. "The station master said it would cause bloodshed to try to expel them," General Knox reported to London. "He had to abandon all hope of travelling that night." In some cities, tram systems had become unusable, as every car filled up with soldiers travelling for free. Ignoring every hardship on the way, the new arrivals continued to flow into Petrograd. No inconvenience of any kind seemed to deter them. Among the first to get back home were two leading Bolsheviks, Lev Kamenev, Lenin's long-serving aide, and Joseph Stalin, both of whom arrived in the capital on the 12th or 25th of March. The first real star to return to Petrograd, however, arrived a little later, on the 18th or 31st of March. He was to play a leading role in Russia's revolutionary politics. Like Lenin's, his return was awaited with something close to reverence. And, just like Lenin, he had done a lot of thinking as his train made its way home. Ikrali Tseretelli was a Georgian, with the bearing of a prince and the tastes of a poet. At 36, his thick moustache still mainly black, he looked as if he had stepped out of a portrait by Pirosmani, for Georgia's famous primitivist would have loved his ashen face and soulful, doe-like, dark-rimmed eyes. Compared with Stalin's pockmarked, wolfish face, Tseretelli's had the austere and fine-tuned appearance of a medieval saint. He also wore a decent suit, which marked him out as a figure to be reckoned with. The background of this Georgian had been a privileged one, but he had devoted his energies to revolution since his earliest youth. He had been elected to the Duma in 1907, but ended up condemned to prison and a long exile, as a result of which he had acquired a moral authority within the Russian left that few could equal. Unlike Lenin, he had remained in the Russian Empire for his entire life. In 1917, the revolution found him in exile in a village not far from Irkutsk. That accident of geography, which placed him twice as far to the east of Petrograd as Lenin was to the southwest, shaped his response to the revolutionary crisis from the outset. The news of the revolution had reached Irkutsk on one of the last Tsarist mail trains. A headline in a newspaper that someone had been careless enough to leave on a desk in the governor's office on the 2nd or 15th of March was enough to start an uproar in the town. The garrison soon joined the revolution, and the old regime collapsed. As local people took control, there was no other option. A committee that included Tseretelli arrested the governor, opened the prisons, and declared Irkutsk to be free. For a few days, the atmosphere was euphoric, not least because the opposition went to ground. But even in remote Irkutsk, 3,000 miles from any front, the revolutionaries had to face the fact that there was still a war to fight. A former Duma member and a pragmatist, Tseretelli was convinced that Russia could not simply leave the field. Like the member of Chita's Soviet ex-com, he also feared the Prussian invader as much as he craved a swift peace. "The revolution would have to find the strength within itself to end it," he wrote on pondering the war, "so as not to surrender our freedom. If not, it would itself become the victim of an external enemy and internal counter-revolution. The chance to test those theories came at once. Irkutsk was an important staging post for freight. Bullets and rifles, flour, steel, rubber and explosive fuses were all sent through it on the Trans-Siberian route from the Pacific port of Vladivostok to the distant Russian front. Tseretelli was no hawk. He had opposed war credit since 1914. But one morning in early March, a message arrived from the railwaymen in town requesting to know what they should do with the consignment of war supplies. To let it proceed meant collaborating with the war. But Tseretelli could not condemn Russian soldiers to die, the sons perhaps of women, right here in Irkutsk, for any principle relating to a European peace. The Georgian remembered the moment as a psychological turning point. It was also exhausting, a first exposure to the agonies of reconciling Marxist theory with practical power. After 10 days of stress like that, Tseretelli's health collapsed. When he boarded his train to Petrograd, he viewed the many hours of travel as an opportunity to rest. His journey was quicker than Lenin's, but it was neither smooth nor peaceful. While Lenin had no contact with civilians in Germany, the homebound exiles on Tseretelli's train were constantly hauled from their seats and asked to address the crowds of villagers that gathered whenever they stopped. Since he had begun coughing blood, Tseretelli himself could only watch. But the audiences his comrades found were bewildered, eager, brimming with half-formed ideas. "I had the impression that the people were looking for leaders," Tseretelli remembered. The prestige of the Petrograd Soviet appeared to be enormous everywhere, far outranking that of the provisional government. But no one seemed to understand exactly how the two were planning to share power. Tseretelli thought he knew. He also thought the people should be told, and told without concession to their political inexperience. As his extensive notes explained, this was a bourgeois revolution, the first stage in a longer process, and workers owed allegiance to the new provisional government. The Petrograd Soviet, like all the smaller Soviets assembling in provincial towns, was not an organ designed to compete with the government for power, but a centre for the unification and political education of the working classes, established to guarantee these classes influence on the development of the revolution. That settled, he sat back to read the newspapers. The shadow of the war grew sharper as his train approached the capital. As far as he could tell from what he read, the provisional government's position was hardening. Its bourgeois leaders disagreed about the country's obligation to its allies, but they all seemed to be convinced that a people freed by revolution would have fresh energy to fight and win. Even Izvestia was taking a more patriotic line. A recent number carried the Soviets' manifesto of the 14th or 27th of March, parts of which now made him glow with pride. "We will defend our freedom steadfastly against all reactionary encroachments from within or without," he read. "The Russian Revolution will not yield before the bayonets of the aggressors and will not permit itself to bow to external military force." The next day's issue described a demonstration by the reserve battalion of the Semenovskis, who had been the latest to turn out in ceremonial uniform and with accompanying military band to make their case at the Taurid. "War to a victorious finish," their red banners proclaimed. "Long live free Russia, and for the defence of freedom and victory over Wilhelm." The reportage gave Tseretelli no idea about the wider public mood, but by the time his train began to slow for its last halt, he had been fully reassured about the soldiers' view of any shameful, hasty peace. Lenin also used his journey to refine some important ideas. He worked non-stop as the train moved, scribbling in a tattered notebook, or summoning trusted colleagues to the front compartment for discussions. His strategy demanded that Europe should take a lead, for the Russia, to which he was returning, was still, in his mind, backward, lacking, burdened by its peasant masses. As he considered his revolution's future, however, there was little opportunity for assessing the German comrade's readiness to rise. His sole contact with the locals took place by accident. The Russians had stopped at Frankfurt in the early evening of the 28th of March or 10th of April. Their carriage might have been a magnet for the rush hour crowds, but it was pulled into a quiet siding, and the German guards and Platten once again made off for the night, heading for friends and beer and the freedom to stretch their legs. The single carriage was discovered when there was no one to secure it. A group of German soldiers pushed in through the unsealed trackside doors. Every one of them had a beer in each hand, Radek remembered, and they fell on us with an unprecedented eagerness, demanding to know if and when there would be peace. The authorities in Germany could not allow a repetition of that outrageous exchange. The Russians had fallen behind schedule at Frankfurt. The next morning at Halle, the private train of the Crown Prince himself was held up to let Lenin's pass. By the time it reached Berlin on the 29th of March or the 11th of April, the sealed train was still running more than a little late, and there was neither jollity nor beer as it was pushed into a siding for another night. The German staff brought in some plates of rissoles. Even Platten was informed that he could not leave the carriage without an escort. Radek reported that the only people he could see on the platform outside were spies. The Russians were stuck in Berlin for 20 hours, and no one knows exactly what they did to pass the time. There is no evidence in any source, however, to support the later allegation that Lenin had a meeting with staff from the German Foreign Ministry. The long delay occurred because the travellers had missed the Wednesday ferry to Sweden. By the time their train reached Berlin, they had the choice of staying there or taking the lonely route to the north coast. The port of Sassnitz, from which a ferry steamed to Sweden every afternoon, was not a very secure option, for it was on the tip of Rügen Island, a strategically vital but sparsely settled outcrop, densely wooded, and with many quiet landing slips and hidden coves. At one point, German diplomatic staff booked a place there in a locked room to hold the Russians for the night, but Berlin was a safer bet. The government could keep its guests under control more easily. While the Russians cleared up those plates of greyish food, the locked room in Sassnitz was cancelled, and a brace of foreign ministry clerks rushed out to buy 3 dozen tickets for the next day's boat. It took 5 hours of slow travel to get to Sassnitz on the 12th of April. If Lenin had been watching at his window, instead of writing, eyes set firmly on the page, he would have had a view of flat pasture, still khaki after months of snow, a northern forest where birch trees outnumbered the oaks and maples of the German south. The light was paler now, a cooler grey, and boggy channels in the fields reflected a rain-laden sky. There were hooded crows, the Russian kind, and the first flocks of migrating cranes, shaggy, grey and ravenous, had begun to pick their way about the wet meadows. The farms and villages, however, were as empty as the ones they had passed in the south, and their horses had been conscripted along with the men. It was a melancholy scene, but any brooding ended as the train approached Stralsund, one of the Baltic's fine old Hanseatic ports. The scream of seagulls were a sign that they had finally reached the coast, though Stralsund was not to be their last stop on German soil. There was no fixed bridge across the Stralsund to Rügen Island, so the carriage had to be loaded onto a ferry, offloaded on the other side, and then sent slowly up the rural track to Sassnitz and the Baltic terminal. A day later than he had planned, Lenin led his troop of Russians onto the steamer Queen Victoria for the 4-hour voyage to Sweden. Their gamble with the enemy had paid off. Rügen's wooded headlands, spreading into the Baltic like amphibian fingers, were the last that most would ever see of Germany. From the Allied government's point of view, the timing could hardly have been worse. The week of Lenin's flight from Zurich had been taken up by the United States declaration of war on Germany. In Paris and London, the final preparations were also in motion for an offensive on the Aisne, Its overall commander, the French general Nivelle, had convinced his British allies that this was the campaign to end the war. The first British part of it, by the Third Army, began on the 9th of April, as Lenin gathered his comrades for their lunch in the Zaringerhof. By the time he was heading north to Stuttgart, a French attack on German observation posts at Saint-Quentin was underway. In Flanders and the Rhine Basin, the spies were certainly observing trains, but what interested them was the movement of troops and material, not Russian émigrés. It was to the credit of the British Intelligence Service that the departure of Lenin's group, reported by Agent SW5 in Bern, was logged at all. In the agent's opinion, however, the revolutionaries in question were in the minority among the Russians in Switzerland and held beliefs of a fanatical and narrow-minded nature. My own view, SW5 considered, is that these people would be absolutely harmless if, which unfortunately is not the case, other Russians had been allowed to return. A few British agents were less equivocal, believing that Lenin was dangerous, no matter what the circumstances. In view of other officers' purported willingness to kill Rasputin, it is surprising that some member of this latter camp did not reach for his service Webley and follow the advice that Somerset Maugham's fictitious spy chief R, for which read C, gave to an operative in a similar case. Shoot him, and shoot him damn quick. Overall, however, the striking feature of British diplomatic and intelligence correspondence at this point was its refusal to accept the finality, let alone the legitimacy, of the February Revolution as a whole. The result of denial like this could sometimes verge on farce. At the end of March, when Leon Trotsky attempted to return to Russia from New York by sea, he was detained by a British officer in the port of Halifax, Nova Scotia. "For the colonel," Trotsky recalled, "the Russian Revolution simply did not exist." Trotsky and five of his associates were taken to a camp at Amherst that was used for German prisoners of war, and there subjected to an examination the like of which I had never before experienced, even in the Peter Paul fortress. They were strip-searched in front of others, interrogated, and taken off and locked up with no promise of release. Their jailers were responding to instructions from a British agent in New York, who had warned London, wrongly, that Leon Trotsky, a pretended Russian socialist, was, in reality, a German. Lenin's journey provoked similar levels of confusion. In Petrograd, Buchanan discussed the sealed train with Paul Milyukov. But the new foreign minister believed Lenin to have damned himself completely in Russian eyes when he accepted German help. Buchanan was not satisfied, but there was nothing more that he could do without breaking his private list of diplomatic rules. Sir Esme Howard, London's man in Stockholm, was more realistic, not least because his office saw so many Russian émigrés and heard a wider range of tales. Howard would have been delighted if he could have found a way of stopping Lenin, ideally before the wretched man set foot on Swedish soil. The most ingenious proposal came from Kiesler, who had his eye on British sponsorship for his beloved Free Estonia. In a private conversation, he suggested that Lenin might be detained as a quarantine precaution. The Bolshevik group, after all, would have arrived from Germany, a country where, according to the Swedish press, 32,000 cases of smallpox had recently been reported. It was an attractive idea, but no one could be sure that such a clumsy intervention might not make the problem worse. While Russia's allies weighed the options and checked the pistols in their desks, Imperial Germany was working equally hard on Lenin's behalf. It turned out that no one in the émigré group had thought to ask the Swedes for transit papers. The Germans had to take over again. On the 10th of April, with Lenin's train heading northeastwards across Hesse, the Foreign Ministry exchanged anxious cables with Stockholm. It was only that evening, as lamps were being extinguished and foreheads wiped, that the Swedish government's approval for the Russians' onward journey finally reached Berlin. It had been a delicate afternoon, and for a few hours it had seemed as if the plan for getting Lenin into Russia might need some last-minute revisions. In the event of the Russians being refused entry into Sweden, a memorandum of the 12th of April conceded, the high command of the army would be prepared to get them into Russia through the German lines. Seasickness was an unexpected blight. According to Radek and Platon, only a handful of the travellers avoided it, including Lenin, Zinoviev, and Radek himself. As the ferry pulled away from Sassnitz, the braver men resolved to stay on deck. They even sang their favourite songs to keep the icy chill at bay, including Lenin's beloved version of They Didn't Marry Us in Church. Radek helped to pass the time by arguing, a talent that never deserted him. But any claim that the Bolshevik leader and his friends remained on deck for the whole crossing is a fantasy. The Baltic was rough, though the worst storms had ended a week before, and the cold was relentless. However cramped and unpleasant the saloon might be, and no doubt blue with Russian smoke, it was the only place where anyone could sit out of the wind. Lenin resigned himself to a few hours of confinement. This was almost the last lap, after all. It was a shock, then, when the ship's tannoy began to squawk his real surname. The Russians had filled in the usual passenger forms when they embarked at Sassnitz. On Lenin's instructions, most had given false names, continuing the anonymity that they had established in Zurich. Now somebody was demanding to know if an Ulyanov was on board, and every nerve in Lenin's body tightened like the sinews of an animal at bay. Perhaps the Swedes intended to arrest him here. Perhaps the British had a man on board. For a moment, he considered evading the fate that was catching up with him. But with a heavy heart, he made his way towards the bridge. He was expecting nemesis or death. What he found was a message from Yakov Furstenberg. The Bolshevik leader's friend and fixer had always intended to meet the boat, but he had waited in vain for Lenin's party at Trelleborg the previous evening. Resourceful as ever, he was checking in advance this time, sending a radio message to the ferry itself before he wasted yet another night. Lenin almost laughed out loud with relief, and he was in a splendid mood by the time Trelleborg came into view. Furstenberg was somewhere there, and he had organized a small reception where the ship would dock, smaller, sadly, than the one he had made ready for the night before. The seafarers were sure they could make out a few red flags. The original plan had been to include the left-wing socialist politician Frederick Ström in the welcoming party, but he was busy with his duties in the capital. Instead, a younger comrade, Otto Grimlund, joined Furstenberg and the mayor of Trelleborg on the Twilight Quay. It was an icy vigil, and Grimlund remembered how the Swedes' spirits lifted as they made out the strapping figure of Platon on the Queen Victoria's deck. A way-faced but excited entourage soon surfaced at his side. As the Russians, dizzy and aching from seasickness, searched for their bags, the Swedish mayor made a short speech. He had just 15 minutes for the entire show. After that, the passengers were herded into yet another train, flags fluttering against the station lights, and then the whole party was off. Their destination was Malmö, and in the first instance, its marvellous Savoy Hotel. This happened to be the nearest place to the railway station, but it was also the best hotel in town. With a commendable instinct for theatre, Furstenberg had ordered a buffet dinner for the Russian travellers there, a gastronomic entr'acte under Art Deco chandeliers. The staff, already legendary for their service, stood ready in the dining room around a generous Swedish smorgasbord. After 3 days and nights in third-class seats, and still weak from their sea crossing, the Russians were confronted by a feast of salmon and rye bread, ham, smoked elk with berries, dill pickles, pike perch, slivered cheese, sour cream, and mounds of gleaming black and coral roe. It took them less than 15 minutes to devour the lot. The only person who disdained the food was Lenin. He had been quizzing Fürstenberg for news since Trelleborg, and had no time to stop talking and merely eat. The interrogation continued for hours on the night train between Malmö and Stockholm. Grimlund, who shared a coupe with Lenin and Fürstenberg, witnessed it all. The Bolshevik leader, he observed, was interested in everything. In Sweden, there had been exciting news. For the premier, Hjalmar Hammarskjöld, had just been ousted, partly in punishment for his strict line on the trade blockade. His successor was an even more conservative figure. But beyond the upper house of the government, and despite the privations of war, Russia's revolutionary triumph had kindled a new atmosphere of hope. As Fürstenberg and Lenin soon agreed, the likely beneficiary was Hjalmar Branting, a socialist, a patriot, and one of the shrewdest political figures in Sweden. The problem was that Branting might not help their cause if things came to a real fight. As a parliamentarian, he would always be open to the suspicion, as a German agent would suggest, that he was not really a socialist at all, but a bourgeois in disguise. And he has a lot of money, likes to drink champagne, and leads a dissipated life. Lenin was avid for the whole story. He was impressed and fascinated by Branting, who had once helped him escape from the Tsarist police. But it was vital for him to get a picture of the Swedish left as a whole. The internationalists, with their anti-patriotic stance, had been under attack, he knew, and his friend Zed Hoglund was in prison. Like other Zimmerwald leftists, Fredrik Ström had become isolated from Branting's wing of the parliamentary Social Democrats. Lenin wanted to know what his allies were planning to do now, and he quizzed Fürstenberg about the trade unions and the resources they might have. Were there youth movements, he pressed, and who led those? What had changed in the past 2 months? Why were these people, his good friends, unable to see that the revolution must be armed? After about an hour of this, Grimlund, who was a journalist by trade, could not help reaching for his pen and pad. The Bolshevik leader was in the middle of outlining his plans for a foreign bureau of the party to be based in Stockholm. But as soon as he caught sight of Grimlund's pen, he saw a new disciple for his cause. As the train headed north through the Swedish night, Grimlund enjoyed a masterclass in politics. Lenin did not need a large audience, he remembered. He would talk to anyone about his ideas. Showing no sign of tiredness, the leader detailed the theses he had been rehearsing since Zurich. His programme was already worlds away from anything that Sarah Terli had imagined as he crossed Russia's countryside a week before. For Lenin, the Soviet was not the provincial government's sub-department for workers' education, but the future master of the revolution. There could be no collaboration with the bourgeoisie, let alone that worm Kerensky. Power should pass to the workers' Soviets. Lenin had no time for the policy that Tseretelli had started to call revolutionary defensism. Far from facing the Germans with fixed bayonets, the people of the entire world should turn their weapons against the oppressor class. The war was the responsibility of imperialists, and they should be the ones who paid for it. Meanwhile, the only valid course in the short term was to demand immediate peace. Peace, bread, and land to the peasants. The message sounded like music to Grimlund, an affirmation of the best hopes Russia's February had raised. If there had been a German spy on board, he would have been delighted too. But there was still a long journey ahead.